Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. This is part two of my sit-down chat with former New South Wales police detective turned host and creator of one of Australia's favourite true crime podcasts, I Catch Killers. It's Gary Jubelin.
Jack Lawrence, welcome back to I Catch Killers.
Good to be back, Gary.
And a hello to listeners of 1 Minute Remaining.
Hello, everybody.
You are. I can see that radio skills coming out.
Like, yeah, so as soon as the microphone's gone, mate, I'm in the zone, just like a sportsman, you know. Just
you sound completely
on.
Different. The Absolutely, moment the yeah, microphone's in front of you.
Yeah, when the microphones are off, I've got the high pitched voice and all the rest of it. But when they're on, deep and sultry. Deep.
Hello, Jack. Yeah. Welcome back.
That's right.
I really enjoyed the part one of our chat. We've gone off script completely.
Yeah,
but that's
I do
great.
Waffle.
No, it's not about waffle. I just find it fascinating what we've been talking about, and I'm going to throw right into the realms of fascinating and. Talk about Wild Bill.
Oh, now, Wild Bill.
Just the name got my curiosity.
Yeah.
But the backstory. Can you fill us in about Wild Bill and how you know him, how you've come to communicate with him?
I don't even know how I found Wild Bill, to be honest. I think he just sent me a random Facebook message one day. He'd heard about what I did. People say, send you a phone. This is a guy who's in prison in Panama, can I say. He's in a Panamanian prison, probably one of the worst prisons in the Western Hemisphere. It's one of those situations where the prison guards don't really go inside themselves. There's guns in there. There's drugs in there. There was a massacre not that long ago. These gangs just started fighting with AKs and all the rest.
And it's basically the prisoners are in there. They put the perimeter around them.
Yeah, and they just look them in there. Yourselves. Yeah, and people stand on the walls with guns, so no one comes out.
Crazy.
But so Bill, how do we even start with Bill? I mean, he's guilty of the crimes he's been convicted of. It took me a long time to work out whether or not I was going to tell Bill's story because of the nature of the crimes,
yep.
And but after sort of talking to him, it's very weird to say, but he's a very likable guy. This is a guy who's committed multiple homicides.
Contract killer.
Well, I mean, look, there is this thing of people say that he wasn't a contract killer, and people just said he killed for greed. Now he admits he killed for greed, but he said he was paid to do it. And that's why he did it. So he's an American guy from country America. He had a great upbringing, so there was none of this sort of trauma behind his background, which you often find in these situations. And he said his criminality all sort of sparked from a divorce and a situation with a judge, and how his wife was kind of let off something she didn't do, and he was. Said, you're going to jail. We're going to put you in jail. And he's like, hold on a second. We both did the same thing. You've given her a $20 fine. You're going to send me to prison for 2 weeks. And he said, at that moment, I snapped. And he goes, well, if they want a criminal, I'll give them the best damn criminal they've ever seen. And it started from there.
Sliding door moment.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, he said he'd always done little things like, he sort of made fake IDs and stuff for his kids at school and sort of that stuff. So he'd always done little bits and pieces, but he just went full-blown criminal. Did a number of things in the United States, which then got him wanted in the United States. He was, at one time, he was one of the most wanted men in the US. He never killed anyone in the US, but he'd, done a lot of crime, fraud.
Frauds and
stuff like that. Yep. So he decided one day, time to get out of Dodge. So he left the US and went towards South America. Once he was down in the South American area, he met some people who were did colorful things in the crime world. They sort of said, what do you do? And he kind of reinvented himself. He was a big guy, and he sort of said, well, I'm a sort of Mr. Fix-It. I do all sorts of things. And then it just sort of snowballed from there. And he, you know, he said, he tells me about the first guy that he killed. Actually, he was a he used to drive boats for drug runners. He was, you know, a captain of one of these boats, and also used to drive boats for people smugglers as well. So he was sort of a boat captain for all these sort of different bits and pieces. And he said one day he was out on this boat with a guy who was supposed to be his sort of, you know, he was the guy with the gun and making sure everything was fine. But he said he was a lunatic and all the rest of it. And Bill said, I always prided myself on my job. Whatever I did, I always wanted to be the best at it. So he wanted to be the best captain of people smugglers. And, you know, he said, I treated everyone on that boat, you know, nicely and all the rest of it. And he said, this guy was just a lunatic and he was doing drugs on the boat. And apparently Bill sort of had a go at him. And then this guy tried to attack him. One thing led to another. He kills him.
Right. That
was his first murder, was, he said, self-defense. But then he gets back to shore. He sees the boss man and he says, well, I didn't see anything. Bill says, I dispose of the situation. And long story short, suddenly they found out, because he was part of a cartel, they found out that he, you know, someone else found out he did it. They weren't happy, so he bails again. And then he gets to Panama. And he sort of gets in with all these highfalutin judges and, you know, high-profile people who need a Mr. Fix-It, as he said. You know, it's a very corrupt country. And he said, you know, they needed things dealt with. And that's where it started. He started doing little things like, you know, just with a baseball bat, you know, teaching people that, you know, don't mess with this person or leave that person alone. Yeah. And he said that just slowly progressed into, obviously, the ultimate.
Stand over a man and then just
evolved into contract killing. And
Not excusing the nature of the crimes, yeah. But you can see how that thing starts to happen.
Oh, it snowballs. Yeah, it's one thing leads to another and leads to another. Yeah, and you go, it's not so bad bashing someone.
Desensitized. You know? I just broke a leg. I didn't kill the person. Yeah. I've killed the person. Yeah. Well, I've killed one.
And he was a bad person anyway, you know, that sort of mentality.
Justified in their own mind.
Exactly. So, you know, and, you know, he fully admits now that he was a moralist person. You know, he did it for money and all the rest of it. Eventually, you know, he gets caught, basically. Long story I won't go into, but he gets caught. He gets sentenced to 46 years in prison in Panama. And he actually did an interview with the Daily Mirror in the United Kingdom. I'm pretty sure, I think that's maybe how I also sort of heard about him, which caused him a lot of issues because, you know, in Panama, if you've got money in prison, you can basically have whatever you want. You know, girls were coming to visit him and, you know, food and all the rest of it. Eating McDonald's and KFC and all that sort of stuff. And this got out in this news article, and then the authorities in Panama cracked down on him.
That wasn't a smart play.
No,
make him too popular.
No, but
he said
the journalist promised me that she wouldn't put my face to this, and I'm like, mate, there's your first mistake. Trust the journalist. and so she did, and she put his face out there, and all these things that he was getting up to, and then the Panamanian authorities cracked down hard on him, obviously, and sent him to a punishment wing, which is even worse than where he was. But he still had this mobile phone. And that's where I got into contact with him. And we were just having sort of, he was on WhatsApp. He sent me voice, you know, WhatsApp messages. I mean, there at night, lying next to my wife, who's trying to go to sleep, and you've got Wild Bill going, hey, man, you know, we should, you know, let's get together and tell the story. And so I did almanard for a long time about it. I spoke to my wife about it. I spoke to Dom, who's my audio guy who helps me out. I spoke to him about it. I said, look, I don't know if we should tell this man's story. You know, and they all sort of said the same thing. Look, you never started this to try and just talk to people who say they're innocent. You know, the idea was to get stories of people incarcerated. And I've spoken to people who are incarcerated who have changed their lives, gang members who are now changed their lives and looking to get out and do better with their lives. And he says he's changed his life.
Yeah.
He, you know, he's a minister now within the Panamanian prison. You know, he says that he helps gang members get away, the youngsters get away from crime, get off the drugs. He's working to do better with his life and be better. So looking at that angle, I was like, okay, so he's saying he's better. He's saying he's changed. So why not tell that story and let people, as we said at the start, let other people make up their mind whether they believe him or not?
I'm so comfortable with that. And I know we've both raised it. And obviously it's something that sits with us. What are we doing letting people tell stories? But let them form their own view. Let the people listen. You might listen to him and, you know, from my listening to the episode, he's charismatic. He talks.
He's a good storyteller. That's for sure. Yeah,
and yeah, that doesn't surprise me because I've seen a lot of what I call good criminals. Not good as in the work they do is good, but they're up at that top level. They are charismatic and can tell stories. But let's have a look at it. I still find it a fascinating story, whether I like him or don't like him. It's an interesting story.
And I think people, you know, my OMR audience is very honest with me, and they'll tell me if they're not happy with something and all the rest of it. They don't, and I'm great, and I'm open to that. You know, I have a Facebook page where I'm on there and I say, you know, hit me with it if you don't like anything. And, you know, and people have come
in. Don't you hate it when they say something bad and you know they're right?
yeah, exactly. But I people think I don't think about these things and, you know, I don't think about victims and I don't think, I'm just putting out a story because, you know, I want people to listen. Yeah. It's not true. I think about these things and if people, you know, even if one person says, you know, I'm so upset by the fact that you did this, like, that affects me, and I do feel bad, and I'm like, oh, God, maybe I shouldn't have done this. And then when I think about it, and then I have a conversation with them and say, hey, and I do, I have spoken to people in my Facebook group and said, hey, this is the reasons why. You know, if you don't believe that's right, you know, it's totally up to you, but this is why I did it, and this is why I'm doing it. And 9 times out of 10, they come around and say, I get it, 100%. I don't really like it, but, you know, that's fine. You know, not everyone's going to like everything you do. So, yeah, so telling Wild Bill's story for me was not an easy decision, and it's not something I just went, yeah, this will get me some clicks because it's insane. But we told it on Wanted, the show Wanted. We told his story of how he was on the run, and we've just released part one of his prison story on OMR. And I'm still nervous about that. You know, I'm nervous about how my listeners will react to that because the show has fallen down this path of people who say they're innocent and such horrendous things like Temujin Kenzu, who has, you know, been convicted of crime he didn't
do. I think it's important putting the spotlight on stories like that. Like, you can't just find all the ones that are innocent because that's going to – you need to understand the full picture.
Mm.
But what you're talking about, our mate that's, you know, done 37 years and still can't get a pardon, or the only thing that will get him out of prison, the pardon, you need to put the spotlight on those stories.
Mm. And, you know, I think – we can talk about this down the track, but I mean, you know, obviously you've done your prison podcast and we talk about, you know, reform and rehabilitation. Bill says he's reformed, he's rehabilitated, he's changed, he's not the person he was once was. So whether you believe or not, again, is up to you, but shouldn't we be looking at it and saying, well, that's what we want. We want people to go into prison and come out changed, not come out the same.
That's where you've really got to break it down for people. And I'm not saying they're ignorant as in they're stupid. I'm just saying if you look at it in totality, yes, there is a punishment that goes with the prison, but the punishment is they're taken away from society.
100%.
Now, whether that's, well, who cares if they're taken away from their family, but we don't have to think like that. We think that is a punishment.
Mm.
But what do we want them to be when they come out? Because most people do come out.
Mm.
Even Bill, if he lives to 100, is going to come out. Yeah. What type of person do you want walking out the prison gates? Do you want this angry person that's just going to take revenge on the world? Or do you want a person that perhaps found redemption? So I'm comfortable with it. And I struggle with it like you, Jack, but I struggle with it from a policing point of view because it's easy in policing to look at things in black and white.
Mm.
Have I gone soft because I'm not in the police anymore? What am I doing having sympathy for, you know, the people I used to put away? But I think it's just, you know, growing, evolving and understanding that it's a complex issue.
I mean, there's so many people that think I'm this lefty who doesn't think prison should exist and, you know, we should live in this euphoric world of, you know, oh, they're not bad people. They've just had a bad life. And it's like, that's not true. There is people in prison. And even the prisoners I talk to say there are people in prison that need to be there. And they should not be out in society because they can't change and that's just the way. There's horrendous, you know, the Ivan Milats of the world and these horrendous people.
You don't let them
out. No, you don't let them out. And, you know, and we don't worry about their rehabilitation because they're not going to change.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look at a guy like David Talley, who I speak to. He's got a 100-year prison sentence, this gentleman.
Talk us through that.
A 100-year prison sentence.
When I hear those sentences, I think, what's this for? Just for dramatic effect? Talk us, what was his offence?
Well, so David Talley had an issue with drugs when he was younger.
Yep.
And always struggled with drugs, like a lot of people do. You know, he struggled with drugs and he was stealing to pay for that habit. Not violent crimes. He was breaking into servos after hours, stealing bits and pieces, selling it to pay for his drug addiction. He was sort of in and out. He was one of these guys in and out. You know, he'd go into prison, come out, do the same thing, go back in and out. And he said on a few occasions, he went in front of the judge and said, I need help. Please, you know, there's a facility in XYZ. And this was many years ago. So there wasn't many of these places around, but he'd say, you know, there's this place I'd love to go to. And the judge has always said the same thing. If you get out and you want to get off the drugs, that's up to you, but you're going to prison. Don't worry, not interested in your drug problem. Anyway, so he was going through this cycle. He had young kids and he did this other crime again after hours, stole some stuff and he was caught. Back in front of the courts and he was set to go to prison for 7 years. And he said to me, he goes, in my mind, I was never going back. I'm not going back to prison. One way or another, I'm not going back to prison. So he said to the judge on that day that he was, you know, being charged, he was in front of the judge. He said, but look, before you sentence me and I get go off to prison, can I have a furlough, they call it, which is a few days to get my affairs in order, say goodbye to my kids and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So the judge grants him that. He goes home, he sees his kids, of course, yet again, devastated, pissed off at dad.
Yep.
Cycle continues. He said, you know, it was breaking his heart. He was stuck in this cycle and he just couldn't do it anymore. Day before he was set to go back to court to be sent off, he decided to try and take his own life. So he grabbed a whole heap of his dad's medication. He was living with his father at the time, took a whole lot of the medication and a lot of booze, mixed them together to try and kill himself. Whatever happens, it didn't work. So his dad gets home from work and sees him in the state he's in and goes to call an ambulance. He says, somehow I get out of my haze, get out of the house, get my dad's car and I just drive. So then dad calls the cops because he doesn't want him to hurt himself or anyone else. Cops then get onto him. Car chase starts. So they get into this car chase. Lasts for a little while. In the process of the car chase, I've watched the whole thing. David hits a couple of cop cars. No one's injured. Those cops stay in the chase. They end up getting him, giving him a bit of a beating. He ends up in hospital for a couple of days, goes back in front of the judge. Now, the judge is furious with him. You know, the judge is like ropeable. Yeah. He's like, well, you could have killed someone. You know, what are you thinking? You know, if you'd killed someone, it wouldn't come back on you. It would have come back on me, you know, blah, blah, blah. He then proceeded to give him the maximum possible sentence he could on every one of his charges, which now included multiple sentences, including assault with a deadly weapon.
On the police car.
So it's assault with a deadly weapon. There was two of those. You know, a couple of other, you know, almost attempted murder type situation. And it all added up to, in total, 100 years. And he said, and he went, maximum, all to be served, one after the other, and that's it. And they're in Florida, there's no parole system. Well, there's a parole board, but no one sits on it because no one gets parole. So he got a 100-year prison sentence without the possibility of ever getting out. And that's it. That's it. That's game over. He cannot get out.
See that on all different levels. That just seems crazy.
It is insane. That, he never killed anyone. He could have gone. He could have hurt someone. He could have killed someone. But we can't convict some people on something they could have done.
A flawed character like he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. They could have. He made a mistake. But yeah, a lot of people make mistakes.
Totally.
But
I made so many. Gary, I think it's pure dumb luck that I didn't at some point in my life end up in a situation like some of the people I talk to. I always say on my show, let he who without sin cast the first stone, because that ain't me.
Yeah.
And I'm not proud of myself.
I think that's a fair comment. Yeah. We all sit there and go, how outrageous.
Yeah.
You know, but 100 years, like, what is that? That's insanity.
But it's not rehabilitation. That's just saying you are going to prison now. And he hasn't touched a drug since the day he went into prison. He is completely clean. He became a law clerk, helping others with their cases, model prisoner, obviously never been in a fight. And he just wants to go home. He's got two kids now. Not two kids now. They're adults now with their own kids, and he just wants to be a grandfather.
How long has he been in now?
26 years, I think. You know, and it's just, you know, I mean, and then people can look at our system and go, our sentences aren't harsh enough, you know, especially when we talk about youth crime as well. People say it's ridiculous, you know, kids just get slapped on the wrist and there's no repercussions, which I tend to agree with. But I also think, you know, that these harsh sentences don't work. I had a couple of prosecutors from the United States on my show and I had this argument with them and they're like, you know, these sentences are in place to deter people from the crime. I said, guys, you've got the highest incarceration rate in the world.
It's not really working, is it?
These high sentences, they're not working.
So we've got to try something. To keep doing the same thing.
Do the same thing over and over again. Yeah. It's insanity. And that's what I say. We've got to look at the system and go, it's like gun reform in this country. There was a massacre in 1996. Yeah. We went, well, we need to change something here. We did. Look what happened. America, their gun situation. They won't change anything. The same shit happens
and it's
time and time and time again.
Continue to happen. On those sentencing, those long sentencing and youth crime, and you know, you're based up in Queensland and here in New South Wales, we're hearing so much about youth crime. It's a difficult one. I do remember speaking to Bernie Matthews, who spent, I think it was 35 years in prison. He was a notorious criminal, but also a very interesting person. And we became friendly after I left the police. Mm. He was an award-winning journalist. He was a good writer, did escape from prison, did all sorts of things. Mm. And when he was, he sadly passed away, but before he was passed away, we had a lot to talk about and we spent a lot of time together. And he was saying that, you know, I said, well, how can we make a difference? You know, like he's been there, and he was smart enough, and there was a decency to him where he could step aside and go, well, look, what I've done, I'm not making excuses, it's wrong.
Yep.
But we've got to make differences when people are young. That's when you can you can change them. I think there needs to be consequences for actions.
Absolutely.
For young kids.
Mm.
If the consequences are you're going to send 15-year-olds to sentence them as an adult and put them in an adult prison, that's just going to breed angry criminals.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because they're literally now going to grow up in the system surrounded by career criminals who are now their teachers.
Yeah.
And all they're going to do is come out angry kids. And people will say, oh, bleeding hearts, you know, we've all had. And my wife will say to me, you know, oh, it's because they're bored. And I don't buy into that.
Yeah.
I'll say that right now. She says, oh, you know, there's nothing for kids to do. I'm like, I had nothing to do as a kid.
But
I didn't go around stabbing people and stealing cars. But, you know, I also had a wonderful upbringing with great parents and all the rest of it. So there's none of that. And then you get people say, well, people grow up in tough conditions. That doesn't mean they have to go that way.
Yeah.
But there is more to it than just going, right. As they do in America, 15-year-olds. There's two guys I talked to right now, the Cain brothers, 15 and 16 years old.
Yeah, tell us about those, because I was reading about that. Outrageous.
Yeah, well, so 15 and 16-year-olds. It's a very confusing story, but essentially they got involved in a long dispute via another friend with a gentleman from their town who wasn't, you know, the prosecution painted him as this, you know, wonderful family man, upstanding member of the community, which he really wasn't. But anyway, they got into this argument. They say they were defending themselves because he came over and attacked them. Zach, the youngest one, ended up hitting the guy across the head with a baseball bat. He fully admits that. The guy was going for his brother. He just grabbed the bat. Yep. He was 15. He swung, hit the guy, and the guy passes away. He dies. So the kids get charged with his murder at 15 and 16, tried as adults, found guilty of murder, and sentenced to over 30 years for the crime. They probably would have got life without parole, but because they were youngsters, there is some rules that they can't give them life without parole, but they give them 30-odd years, which is basically their entire lives anyway. And they went in, we're basically the same age, me with these kids, so they're in their 30s, late 30s. The eldest about to turn 40.
And they went into the adult prison system.
And they were literally, so they went into adult prisons. They were separated, the brothers were separated, and they had a Mark. There's another young man, Mark, who also went to prison for the same crime, and he was a friend of theirs. So two of them, Zach and Mark, go to one prison together, and then Jeremy goes to another prison by himself. Adult facilities, where they are told by the head, you know, the prison, what do you call them, the boss of the prison, said, you've got to fight. You have to fight.
Yeah.
If you don't fight, you're going to get eaten up alive. If you get into a fight, as long as you don't, you know, stab anyone or any of that, I will turn a blind eye. But you have to fight.
Yeah.
You've got no other option. And Zach, the youngest, he's been stabbed multiple times. And they grew up in prison. And, you know, only recently they've been to move to a what they call a work camp where they get released to actually go out into the community and work. They're allowed to do that, but they won't get out on parole. But they're allowed to do that. But they haven't seen the first time Zach said, I walked in this place and there were no walls. Because they don't have the traditional, it's not the traditional setup.
I can't imagine what it does to your mind, spending a long time in prison. That's your world. But I also can't imagine anything more terrifying as a young kid sent.
I can't imagine anything more terrifying as a 37-year-old man.
Yeah, well, I'm talking tough here. If I was a kid, I wouldn't be scared then.
Oh, I'd shit myself now, Gary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Again, consequences, the nature of the crime, it's a murder, yes. But are we setting up for more failure? Are we setting up to create angry people if you send them in that environment? That's such a difficult thing.
Yeah, and I'm not saying a kid, you know, commits a murder and there shouldn't be repercussions, and there shouldn't be serious repercussions, absolutely serious repercussions.
It's a difficult one. I had a case that it sort of stuck in my mind because I could see it being circumvented. It should have been stopped before it got to murder.
Mm.
These kids, and they were kids, 15, 16, around that age, like teenagers, started breaking into a school canteen. They broke into a school canteen and multiple times it wasn't investigated and they got away with that. They became a little more emboldened by that. And they weren't like bad kids. They weren't gang members. They weren't set up to be horrible human beings. They then started robbing some shops, got away with that. All of which, if they were investigated, could have been stopped.
Yeah.
You could have got them at the canteen stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe come down hard on them the first time.
Scare them straight sort of thing.
Scare them straight, consequences for actions, put them on programs, whatever. Break the cycle. They got away with breaking in the shops. They then broke into a house. They started breaking in the houses. They found a house that had a gun that wasn't secured properly. They took a gun. They then, again, if it was investigated properly, perhaps you could have caught them and caught them at that stage. So you see it build up. Then they decided, we're going to rob a liquor store. And went in there, did an armed robbery. Kids, you could tell it was B grade the way they were doing it.
Mm.
Could have been sorted. Then they got away with that. They decided they're going to rob a lady. She was walking home from the railway station after doing Christmas shopping, just a couple of days before Christmas. They wanted to take a handbag. She resisted. Their kids, they're panicked. They shot her, killed her, killed her on the spot. And I look at that and think there were so many times that could have been circumvented. So, it brought home to me, you can't let kids get away without consequences for actions.
Absolutely.
Because it then escalates and it becomes a home invasion. It gets out of hand, that type of thing. But maybe we've just got to put the resources into grabbing them right at the start when you're seeing them go off track. Like I can tell a kid if it's going off track. There's that crucial stage at 12 to 15 where they can go off track overnight.
Mm.
I was coaching my son's soccer team around those ages, and you could see kids that just changed overnight. They got in with the wrong crowd and went in the wrong direction. They were almost marked for life that they're going to head off in the wrong direction. So how do you impact on youth crime? And we hear it. I'm not sure why we're hearing it so much about what's happened in Queensland, but it's hitting the media, and we talked about the media, but they're the headlines, the youth crime out of control up there. Something's got to be done to break the cycle. Mm. You know, smarter people than me will work out what, but I think if you let it get away, then it can sort of escalate.
And I think there's also an opportunity to use people who have been in that situation. You and I both know Russell Manser.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And he's spoken about how, you know, we just want to grab these kids and they can show them the reality of where they're headed, you know, and actually have a probably a serious impact on them and say, you know, because they may even possibly look up to them in this whole criminal mindset. Look at these guys, you know, ex-bank robbers, this is cool. And then they go, well, actually, kids, it's actually not cool at all. And this is where you're headed. But we don't utilise those people.
I love what you just said there, Jack, and there's so many people we've had on the podcast that have got their stories because they've walked in those paths.
Mm.
And I'm talking, you know, the bikies that, you know, kids, if they want to go off track, they want to be in gangs, they'll look up to a bike and go,
cool.
Oh, look, he's a tough guy.
Yeah. People are scared of him. Give him respect. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know?
And if they come in there at that early stage and go, guys, there's so many other paths you can follow, then you don't want to go down this because this is what's happened. And you hear Russell's story, and it's just horrendous.
Mm.
If he was getting out telling people that, other people that we've had on the podcast, so many of them, I think, have got such a powerful story to tell young kids, and maybe that's what we've got to look at and getting those people involved. Because when you're a kid, a teenager, you're rebelling. I don't care what the teacher tells you. I don't care what your father tells you. I'll look up to people that I think have got something that I wanted to be part of.
Mm.
So
I mean, when I was a kid, I thought the mafia was cool. Yeah. I mean, I soon learned very quickly that it's not cool whatsoever, no. You know, and there's the criminal world, I think, to a youngster, as you said, I mean, it can look alluring because, you know, a lot of the time, again, the media or the TV and all that makes it look alluring and, you know, yeah. You see these people getting respect and all the rest of it and you think, oh, that would be cool. You don't actually see all the awfulness behind it.
No, well, I spent some time touring around the country with Michael Francis, the mafia bloke on a live show. And had him on the podcast. And, you know, at his peak, I think he was earning $8 million a week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it sounds pretty good to me,
And he had boats and aeroplanes, helicopters and all that. But, yeah, sitting down and spending time with him, he looks back and he does a lot of talk now and he's found a different path in life and lessons learned. And it's a brutal business. Mm. He said, yeah, your best mate might be the one that puts a bullet in the back of your head. Mm. You never knew. Mm. If it was your days were up, your days were up. You're called to a meeting and he went to a meeting fully expecting to be shot on the spot.
And his own father sort of okayed it in a way. He said, I'm not going to get in the way. I mean, that's insanity.
I know. Dad, did you really
come on.
They expect a little bit more. Come
makes for the discipline as a child that I had may look like child's play, that's for sure.
Yeah, you've got to toughen up, Jack.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk about the legal system, United States compared to Australia.
Yeah.
What's you've seen both. What differences do you see?
I suppose the biggest difference, you know, I spoke to you about this briefly, is elected officials. You know, you look at your judges, your prosecutors, you know, those people in power. They're elected into those positions by the public. So they're part sort of legal person, part politician. So, and you know, we know what politicians, not having to go politicians, but we know what they do. They tell you what you want to hear so that they get re-elected and they still have a job. So these, you know, you'll notice that come election time, all of a sudden incarceration rates are sort of getting up because they're tough on crime. You know, because people love to hear that. They love to hear tough on crime. We're going to get the bad people off your streets and we're going to put them in prison. Fantastic. Let's vote for that guy. So number one, I think that's the biggest thing, you know, because I feel like that can skew someone's judgment, you know. Especially, you know, some of the cases I've heard about with judges are there to, you know, be in control of that courtroom and question things. And you go, how's this got past the judge? You know, a classic example again, Temujin Kenzu. How did the judge allow half of what was going on? This is your courtroom, mate. You're supposed to say, hold on a second, guys, what's going on here?
And, the judicial system, the judges, barristers, the whole system, they're put on a pedestal. Mm. They really are. And I think there needs to be scrutiny.
Mm. Absolutely. They've got so much power.
So much power, but don't seem to be accountable.
Mm.
I find it amazing that I've seen people, and I'll flip it a little bit because we're talking like we're left-wing. Let's flip it a little bit.
Absolutely.
I've had people that I've charged with crimes and they haven't been convicted.
Yeah.
And I've been angry because I think enough there. But do we have a way of appealing? And then there's all these people I've had convicted of murder, and the majority of them, unless they plead guilty, and very few plead guilty to murder, appeal the decision.
Yeah.
And the courts allow the appeals to go through.
Yeah.
I've tried to do it from reverse, where someone was acquitted, and we tried to get the decision overturned in the double jeopardy legislation.
Mm.
My God, you not only had to change legislation, just the animosity towards, hold it, this is a system that's been in place for years. How dare anyone question that the courts have got it wrong?
Mm.
So I think there's an intellectual arrogance about the court system that, and I'm talking this country, and what you've said in the United States. It's almost like, we're right, you're wrong, go away, don't annoy us.
Mm. Yeah,
I think that causes problems.
Oh, it totally does. I mean, I make no qualms about it on my show when it comes to the jury system. I don't like the jury system at all.
Yeah, you said that the other day when we were talking.
Yeah, I don't. You know, you're asking 12 complete strangers who have no idea about law and different, you know, things like circumstantial evidence. They don't understand it fully. I mean, even now, I mean, I've been doing this now for 15 months and I read a lot of legal stuff and trial transcripts and I'm listening to these, you know, prosecutors and defense attorneys and I'm going, what, you said what? And I have to read it four or five times. I still don't understand what they're saying. There's all this legal jargon that they're using and so confusing and you're expecting 12 people who don't know the law to come up with a decision on someone's innocence or guilt. But then you also have, you know, people's personal bias come into that as well,
yeah.
You know. And then you have the media. Again, we come back to the media. You know, these people are told, don't you dare look at anything on the internet or the TV, you know, don't you.
It's like, fingers crossed.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as they go out, they go, you know, let's have a look at what's going on here. So, you know, I think the whole system, when it comes to the jury system, is flawed. But, I mean, you know, and in America, I mean, I don't know the full ins and outs of how they do the jury system here, but obviously in America, they do a jury pool and they get to pick and choose and ask questions and say, you know, I have a defense attorney who joins me on my show every time we do a case, and he said that they've now started asking, do you listen to podcasts? And he said, you know, if someone was to say in America, I listen to 1 minute Remaining, chances are they'll be kicked off.
Yeah, we don't want
because they've got a bias in one particular way. So, you know, again, there's a jury selection of, you know, well, we don't want that person because that's not going to help us out. We don't want that person. So it's like, hold on, this is obviously a jury of your peers. Surely you should just be random, bring them in. You know, do they fit the sort of same criteria as what the person's on trial for? Yes or no? I mean, look at the Cain brothers, you know, complete opposite when it comes to, obviously, we talk a lot about black people, African-Americans being, you know, a completely white jury. They had the opposite. It was a couple of white boys from Alabama who had a completely black jury. And, you know,
so you can have those biases, even if they're unconscious bias.
Absolutely.
Come into play. With the jury system, and I've been thinking about it since you said I'd prefer to go judge alone.
Yeah.
And I've been involved in matters when I was in the police from both sides, like judge alone and or jury. Mm. A couple of problems. Like I worry when it's one person making the decision. That causes me concern because as much as they say they're impartial,
they still have they're human
and they've got grudges to they're bearing grudges on certain things.
Very
and
true.
They've got their own biases, and I think when they put themselves up on a pedestal, that won't impact my decision. And there's safeguards there. I don't want to be totally critical of our legal system.
Yeah,
I've seen it work. I've seen it work beautifully. But I've also seen it fail horrendously. One thing that concerns me with the jury system is, they call it the voir dire, where the jury is excluded because we've got evidence to discuss
without the
jury there. Yeah. And it happens just time and time again. What happens, because when I was a police officer, I was sitting in there when I was involved in the case, but the jury was excluded. Quite often there's evidence that's presented, like the evidence is there, but we don't want to put it in front of the jury because it would be too compelling. Mm. The information, the best way I could explain it, if the information was put through before the jury, like let's say you've robbed 100 banks and we've caught you for robbing one bank, well, we're not going to, if the jury were told, well, you've been convicted of robbing 99 banks.
Chances are you're going to get, yeah.
Probably not a good example,
but
those type of things. My frustration is that we've said the jury are, you're going to be judged by your peers because you've got these 12 people, whether they're wise or not, but it balances out because they're your peers. That's the people that's judging you. But they're not smart enough to have all the information put in front of them. The legal people are going to tell you what goes in front of them. That frustrated me time and time again. I see the jury, and you can see the look on the jury's face because court confuses me, and I spent my working career in and out of courts. The look on the jury's face going, what's been said in there for 4 hours while we were asked to leave? What's going on? Mm. We're asking us to judge this person's guilt or innocence, but you're not allowing us to see all the information that's readily available. It causes me concern. You also raised about, now, you're not allowed to look this case up.
Yeah.
And that. It was the directions from the judge in the early days of my policing career was, now, you're not allowed to watch the news or read the newspapers. It's very important that you don't...
Or talk to anyone about this story or anything.
This.
Yeah.
And then I think anything that's running, you can Google it.
Yeah.
I think we've got to accept, maybe the warning by the judges might be, you can get a look at these things, but the things that you've got to judge your case on, or guilt or innocence, is on the factual information that's presented to the jury. Give us enough credibility to be able to do that if you're on the jury.
And I think, you know, again, that's very hard for people to do because as soon as they see something, they start getting those biases come in, you know, and you have to say, and I say this a lot to the people listening to my show, you know, you've got to take emotion out of this. You know, yes, we're going to talk about a story that is horrendous and it's sad and this person may not come across in a great light in certain aspects, but listen to the facts or the, you know, what the case that is brought against them, and you've got to work out whether you think, based on the evidence that's been provided, you think they are guilty or not. I've got a story that's just about to start, actually. It was a big story over in the United States where a gentleman was accused of murdering his daughter. Terrible story, very emotional story. She was never found, so she's never been found. Mm-hmm. But straight Dave won. They didn't believe his story. It was almost like a very, very similar to the American Nightmare story. He said, his daughter was abducted while driving, drove off with the car, and he said that was it.
Same, yeah.
Yeah. So they accused him of this, and he was arrested for it. Went in front of the jury, but there was question marks around how he disciplined his children. So he was a disciplinarian. You know, he had this thing that he called a paddle, which is a little stick with some, you know, it was a cushiony thing that he taped to it. And he said he would tap them on the butt if they did something wrong. And there was also, you know, suggestions that he would, you know, discipline his young kids when it came to toilet training.
Yep.
So, you know, stuff that I personally wouldn't do, but he was disciplining his children. But, you know, and then they sort of went with that narrative and how he was, you know, he beat his child to death because she wet the bed. That was their whole thing. So then the jury hears that and think, what a monster. But if you actually look at the evidence that was presented, they had a cadaver dog. They used a cadaver dog, and a cadaver dog is trained to sniff out deceased,
remains.
The smell from deceased bodies. And if you look at really what that dog indicated on, it indicated on her car seat. But then their claims are that he carried his dead daughter out. You know, he moved her around, he put her in the seat, all the rest of it. The dog didn't indicate on his clothes or, and the, you know, even the handler said, you know, this the odour will transfer onto all things this kid has touched. He was supposed to have sat his kid up in the lounge room to make her look like she was still alive, and the dog never indicated any of that stuff. And obviously the child was never found, and, you know, even the mother of the child, they were separated. She doesn't believe that he did it either. But if you look at the evidence, you actually look at the evidence, take the emotion out of it, the way he disciplined his child, whether you know, agree with the way he did it or not. But if you look at the evidence, take emotion out of it, you've got to question his conviction. But that's the thing. Emotion comes into it. People's biases come into it. And it takes over. And it's funny, I was actually watching, because on YouTube, it was a very big story from the United States. And I was watching YouTube clips of someone uploaded the documentary. There's a part one and all the way through. You read part one, the comments in part one, what an evil person, blah, 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 all this sort of, you know, what a rotting hell, you know, scum, blah, blah, blah. By the time you get to the end on YouTube, you're seeing I don't think he did it. Yeah. And all these comments, and they're completely changed because they've heard the whole story and seen everything.
Yeah.
And they've gone, oh, hold on a second. When you look at it like that, I don't think he did this. So that's, you know, again, jury biases and that sort of stuff.
But it's taking that emotion out of it. And,
and it's hard to do.
It is hard to do. And this is what I struggle with. There's a balancing act, because I've seen more miscarriages of justice when the doors are shut to the media going on. And I'm sitting there thinking, is this really happening?
Yeah, right.
Than when the doors are open to the media.
Yeah.
But also what you're talking about and what I've seen, that the media headlines, that feeds a narrative, and then it just sort of snowballs from there. I'm a big believer in that there needs to be transparency in the justice system. Mm. So there needs to be that scrutiny from the media.
Mm.
It's not perfect, but I believe it's a better position to be in than the door shut. You know, what goes on in the family law courts? Well, no one knows because the media don't report on it. But then you speak to someone that's been through it, and you hear all these complaints because there's no scrutiny.
Mm.
What's your view? Do you think the courts need to be scrutinised by the media? Transparency?
I think there needs to be transparency, but this whole innocent till proven guilty, I think that's a fallacy, if I'm honest. I think it's a complete fallacy, because as soon as someone is, you know, you see that article, you know, whether it be a boyfriend, partner, whatever it is that's been accused of some crime, we instantly go, well, he wouldn't have been arrested if they didn't have the evidence for him.
Yeah,
so it must be, it looks dodgy. You know, you look at Madeleine McCann's parents, you know?
Yeah.
Straight away, I was like, guilty as sin. I mean, it's still obviously a bizarre story, but it is that whole, there's no such thing as guilty until proven innocent. Innocent until proven guilty. It's guilty until you can prove yourself innocent, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And I think the media, you know, as they do help people accountable, I think it's important. You know, I was a part of a media organisation for many, many years. But I also think that, you know, there's also situations where you go, guys, you know, I don't know, it's a really tricky one.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you spoke to a prisoner on you know, Breaking Badness, who I thought had a good suggestion. He's like, why can't it be presented after the fact?
Yeah.
Why can't we have, like, they can report on it, they can get all the information, all that sort of stuff. And once it's gone through the courts, guilty or innocent, then report on it.
Yeah. I can understand, and that prisoner, I understand where he's coming from. I just worry if there's not scrutiny, and this is, I don't have a hard fixed rule. It's almost judging each case by its merits.
And that's the other thing,
But, yeah, you mentioned Madeleine McCann. William Tyrrell, which I am disappointed is sort of understating what's happened in the past couple of years where they've come out and said, senior police come out and said there's only one suspect in this and virtually name the suspect without naming the suspect.
Yeah, yeah.
And the pressure that's put on those people. Now, that was done almost 2 years ago now.
Mm.
And still, no one's been called into account for it. It's the only one that's been called into account on the William Tyrrell matter is me.
Mm.
On that's the only scrutiny. It sits uncomfortably with me.
Mm.
And I say to everyone in the public, you know, the thing that's been missed by all the chaos that's gone around the William Tyrrell matter is a three-year-old child has disappeared.
Mm.
And there's so much speculation, and it's the nature of the crime. You know, if someone sneezes about William Tyrrell, it's on the front page, front page of the paper. And I understand that. I understand because of the nature, a beautiful young kid just disappears. But I say to people, let's just wait and find out what comes out when the truth comes out. And I'm still hoping the truth does come out about the whole situation. But, it concerns me. It concerns me what the person named as the only suspect is going through and how no one seems to be accountable for dropping that.
And that's what we say the media this, the media that, but they're getting their information from the source, which is, you know, the investigators, and they're getting fed information and then they're taking that information and running with it, as you would.
Well, I heard when when we're getting on controversial topics, but it sort of, it is personal to me when we talk the William Tyrrell matter, is that when it came out that a report had been provided to the DPP about sufficiency of evidence, whether there was sufficient evidence to charge a person, and I saw a senior police officer get up and say, because I've taken plenty of those reports to the DPP and it doesn't get released to the media.
Mm.
How was that released to the media? And it was asked a question, not by me, I'm staying away from it, I'm too close to it.
Mm.
But it was asked by someone in the media, what is happening with the release of information? Is there going to be an investigation? And the senior officer said, yes, there will be an investigation. I haven't heard the results of the investigation, but who did leak that information? I'd like to find out.
Mm.
I seem to be accountable for everything that happened that I did on William Tyrrell. Who's the person that released that information to the media? So they felt comfortable enough to report. The report has gone to the DPP. It's not like it was something you couldn't avoid. The media were going to find out.
Mm.
It's taking the report and dropping it off at the office of the DPP. Why was that information released and who released it?
And it is that word accountability because, you know, again, looking at the United States where I look at, you know, all this stuff comes to light that detectives did wrong or, you know, they hid information and prosecutors have been done for prosecutorial misconduct and nothing happens to them.
Yeah.
You know, nothing happens, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the American Nightmare show where those investigators who did horrendous job, they're getting awards at the end of it.
I've got to thank you because when we had that conversation a while back, you said, oh, look, you got to watch this American Nightmare.
Yeah.
On Netflix, it sounds like an ad we're doing
well,
for it.
Well, Netflix owe me some money because I've been spreading the word on that show to everybody. It's crazy.
Three episodes. We won't spoil the...
No.
Probably will spoil the ending, but watch it anyway. You told me to watch it. I was just gobsmacked by what happened in that on that series. And
it's not unusual, Garrett. It's not unusual.
Well,
that's how they work.
That's when I was talking to you before the in prep for the podcast, you were saying, have a look at that. This is the very thing that I'm talking about.
Mm.
And it was horrendous what happened on that case.
Yeah.
A girl, and just so people would tell a bit of the backstory of it, the girl was a abducted from a home, at home with a boyfriend, and someone broke in, and she was abducted. And
weird
she,
circumstances. Weird. The whole thing was weird.
Weird. And you said it to me. If I was a police officer, I'd be looking at, is this girlfriend and boyfriend making it up? Because she turned up 2 days later.
Well, before she turned up, they were accusing him of killing her.
Yeah.
So straight away, you've killed her, haven't you? We know you've done it. You know, put him on a lie detector. Oh, you lied. You're not telling the truth. So he was their number one suspect. I said to you off air, if she hadn't turned up, I guarantee you I'd be talking to him on 1 minute remaining about the fact that he was in prison for something he didn't do.
And, well, I can't argue with you, Jack, because you're right. You're right on that.
Yeah.
But yes, watching the interview, and we talked on tunnel vision and the danger of tunnel vision. In the interview room, you've got to have a crack.
Mm.
You know, if you're investigating a crime and the circumstances, hindsight's a wonderful thing. I look back and go, well, yeah, I wouldn't have done it that way. Well, I know the result now.
Mm.
But circumstances, the story that played out that, you know, someone broke in and we're asleep and then tied me up and...
Yeah, it was crazy. I think everyone watching it goes, well, this is...
Put headphones on with strange music playing.
Yeah.
It was bizarre.
Yeah, well, totally bizarre.
So I would imagine the police looking at that would be the starting point.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you go on your hunch, you go on your instinct, but you've got to overlay it with the facts.
Yeah.
And so that can point you in a direction. I think they headed off in the direction I would have headed, and I think any reasonable person would have at the time, but they had to check themselves, and they didn't check themselves at any time.
Mm.
And
I spoke to a guy once, a doctor over in the States, who told me about the Sherlock effect, which is this notion that, you know, a lot of detectives, and he says doctors as well, they see the result of it and work their way back. They see, you know, okay, well, this is what's happened, and they work. Instead of, you know, finding the evidence and working their way towards the crime, it's the other way around. They're surmising and saying, well, I know what happened, and they kind of get this sort of ego again comes into it where they're like, well, you know, I'm a seasoned detective. You know, I know, you know, I've got great intuition. I know that this person's lying to me. And I think that's a perfect example in that case of
It's a classic example. And here I am when you're saying that to me. I've got this strange look on my face because I'm thinking, was that me? But the fact that I can look and think, okay, got to make sure I don't become that.
You're checking yourself, yeah.
And I learnt, and again, I tribute the detective I turned out by the mentors that taught me and the people I learnt from. Briefings were so important. And very early in my career, you come into a homicide squad, the murder team or whatever. It's pretty intimidating your first time there. And some people that I looked up to, they would look around the room, and they're very seasoned homicide detectives, and there's some junior police, and they'd, you know, this is the first time I've been in a room like that. Gary, what do you think? And they'd go around the room, and that's the way they balance that out.
Yeah.
And they listen. And, you know, sometimes as a detective, and especially if you're leading the hard cases, you've got to make the hard calls. Mm. Like, it's a robust game that you play. Well, it's not a game. I hate it when, and I just did it.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be called a game because lives really, lives are lost and lives are destroyed by the actions that you do. And sometimes you've got to make decisions, but you've got to be careful those decisions that you make because of consequences. So getting back to that show, the evidence that was presented to the detectives, I wouldn't have believed that story.
No.
First up.
No, totally, 100%.
And I think everyone sitting there, I wasn't sure which way this was going to go. I know you referred it to me, and I didn't know which way it was going to go. But when there started to be chinks in the armour, they didn't want to look anywhere else, did they?
No.
And then just moved on.
Yeah, and that's the problem.
And the other thing, and we spoke about this before we started recording today, because I told you I watched it, it just infuriated me about some of the lazy police work that was done, some of the lazy police work that impacted on people's lives that they just couldn't be bothered. Mm. And I think you said your brother.
My brother's an ex-cop, and I'm going to have him on to talk about it, and he was watching it. I said, watch this, because I need you to talk about it. And he was messaging me while he was watching it, just like so angry about what he was saying and how it was being handled. And he's like, I cannot believe this is even a thing. It's insanity.
It is insanity. It's embarrassing. Mm. And saying that, it was, the flip side is that it was good detective work that actually...
100%, yeah. A police officer came in and actually did the job properly and you know, sorted the whole thing out.
Sorted out in the long run. But, it's the justice system. I think honestly, that's why we're fascinated with it, because you just don't know where the truth lies.
Yeah.
And we all think we're detectives. I think what the interest is. In all the guests that you've had on the podcast, is there anyone that's really surprised you? Like, you've had a sort of preconceived idea of what you're going to get with this guest, and you've spoken to the guest and you've gone, oh, didn't expect that.
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, there's so many people. Like, there's so many fascinating people that I talk to. But I mean, Jason Vukovic is one guy that I found his story because there was this image that was sort of circulating around the internet, kept sort of popping up of this guy in prison yellows, big dude, tattoos, and he's looking across, you know, this courtroom. It's sort of like two worlds colliding. There's another gentleman on the other side of the beard, fully in a suit, very smart, businesslike, and they're just smiling at each other. And then underneath this sort of thing was, this is Jason Vukovic. He was convicted for assaulting sex offenders, pedophiles, who he found on the sex offenders registry list. This is him smiling at his brother after he'd been convicted type thing. And it painted this sort of picture of this vigilante who was, you know, going out and bashing these people and, you know, good for him, high fives all around sort of thing. And I was like fascinated by this. So he's in prison in Alaska. He's called, this is why they call him the Alaskan Avenger is the nickname that he got.
Is that the
yeah,
name?
Yeah. And I sort of, so I tracked him down through his sister and we started talking. And when he called me, very eloquent gentleman, very well read. And he told me his backstory. And I was just floored. Like, this is a gentleman who was abused himself as a child. For many, him and his brother were abused as children by their stepfather, who was, very into the church. And this is not attacking the church, but this was the story. He was very into the church and he was abusing these two boys for many years until both of them decided to run away. They got stopped by the cops who found them, like I said, were underage, yeah, driving a car, taken back. You know, they basically said what was happening to them. Their stepfather was taken to court over the incident. Jason was taken to the court as well. He was taken into a back room by his stepfather's attorney, who was paid for by his church, and said, look, you've got to downplay this, basically, because otherwise, you know, he's going to go away for a long time. He does, you know, sorry for the things he did. You know, they're bringing in, you know, the sins and all the rest of it, all that sort of, you know, churchy stuff, hiding behind the veil of the church. And his father, or his stepfather, ended up getting a 3-year suspended sentence for the crimes that he'd done to Jason. And, you know, this is not just sexual, it's beating them and all the rest of it. Horrendous stuff that he went through. And he was sent home that day with them. And he said, and it obviously just got worse.
Yeah.
And he eventually ran away. His brother ran away as well, and his brother went somewhere else, and he ran away. And then Jason ended up down this sort of path of crime. He ran away. He said his mother and his stepfather basically destroyed all his stuff. He left with nothing. You know, he had no ID, no nothing. Tried to get a job until it came to payday, and the guy's like, I can't pay you. I need your social security stuff and all the rest of it. So he couldn't pay him, so he then started stealing. And then that sort of just progressed and progressed and progressed. And he was, you know, stealing left, right, and center, did a bit of time in juvenile, started taking drugs, just basically going completely down the wrong yeah, path. No help from anyone, you know, about his past or anything like that. Until eventually he gets to this point where he's a lot older. He goes back to Alaska. He said, he was in a bar one day and this couple were telling him, or this two girls were telling him about this guy that had abused them. And he decided to go pay him a visit. And he paid him a visit and he beat him up and said, I know who you are. I know what you are. If you don't stop, I'll be back. And then he decided to go on to the sex offenders registry list in Alaska and found these people and found people living in the area and would sort of scope it out and ask people in the community about the situation. And he'd find out these people were still doing what they were doing. Yeah. And again, he would visit people, go around, beat them up, steal some of their stuff, and be gone. And eventually he was caught, and he was sentenced to 27 years in prison for his crime. He was three sex offenders basically, you know, yep, spoke out against him, and he was convicted of that crime. And talking to him, obviously you get this picture of this big guy, tattooed, who's been bashing people, and you're like, but when you sort of, you know, really peel back the layers, yeah, you discover a guy who's, and I'm not, you know, you get to the subject of the vigilantism and all that sort of stuff and what's right and what's wrong and all the rest of it. You know, I know a lot of people would high five and say, you know, good on him. Whereas a lot of people say you can't take, you know, law into your own hands. But sort of at the crux of it is this guy who has never got help. You know, even in his system, even in the prison he's in now, he's actively tried to get help to sort of uncover, you know, talk about his past, yeah, and, you know, unpack everything. But the prison won't allow it. They don't allow him to talk to anyone. He said, I'll pay for it on my own money. Don't allow it. And it was funny. It's not funny. It's that image. I said to him, tell me about that image. And he said, the day my brother and I both ran away, we never saw each other again. Right. He said, that's the first time I'd seen my brother in 15 years or whatever it was, some ridiculous amount, yeah, of time. He said, that's the first time I'd ever seen him. He came to my court case to speak on my behalf and to talk about the abuse we suffered and all the rest of it. And he said, that was the last time I ever saw him again. Because he came to see me after that. We sat down and he said, you know, I love you very much, brother, but seeing you reminds me of the past.
The trauma.
And I can't do that anymore. I've moved on with my life. His brother's a very successful man. See, and it shows how you can go down different paths. You know, his brother got the help that he needed at a younger age. He was lucky enough to find a family who sort of took him in and paid for, you know, help, basically, and he got the help he needed, and he went off to become a very successful man, travels around the world and all the rest of it. Whereas his brother didn't get the help he needed, went down this path of crime, and now he's in prison.
That story just saddens me.
It's terribly sad.
There's no joy in that story, but it's probably a good example of how complex courts, the world of crime is, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't know what it's all about. I can imagine a lot of people having sympathy for him. I have sympathy for him without supporting vigilantes, but I have sympathy for him.
Yeah.
I think that particular story, it just demonstrates that crime is not one-dimensional.
And that's exactly why I love what I do, and because, you know, you can see an image like that and people have this perception of high-five, vigilantism, what a great guy. And then you actually find out the story. And you, if it's not that simple, it's crazy.
Well, Jack, you told me at the start you don't consider yourself an investigative journalist.
No.
That sounds like a little bit of investigation done from a photo. So I just like to say I've loved the chat that we've had, but I'm also fascinated by the stuff that you're doing. So I hope you keep up the good work, and I hope we can get an opportunity to speak again.
No, absolutely. I appreciate the invite down to these swanky studios. It's been a pleasure. I've been wanting to chat with you for a long time, so it's nice to be here. I'm going to go away a little bit jealous of what's going on in this room and make some changes when I get home.
Can you do up the laundry before I come up to your studio?
Yeah. And I was just telling my wife, you know, when guests come, you've got to direct them to the toilet, you know, please. I'll get slapped in the face and kicked out.
You're creating a false image about what happens here at iCatch Killers. We're doing it tough.
Absolutely. Battlers. Aussie battlers here.
We're just doing the best we can. But it's been a real pleasure. So let's do it again sometime.
I do appreciate it, Gary. Thank you.
Cheers.
There it is, my chat with Gary Dublin from iCatch Killers. Of course, I want to say a massive thank you to Gary for welcoming me with open arms into the iCatch Killer stunning studios. It's like going into business class and now coming back to economy. Here we are in the Prison Pod HQ. a huge thank you to Gary. Absolutely great chat. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I also want to take the opportunity to say a big thank you to Dan Box and Emily Pigeon as well for helping put this all together. And of course, if you haven't listened to iCatch Killers, the link to the show is in the description of this episode. Go and have a listen. There is like hundreds of episodes for you to binge right now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.